Hey everybody, and welcome back to the podcast. This is show number 27, and tonight we're joined by Zeb Andrews, who talks about his journey into pinhole photography, some of the projects he works on, his work with Syrian refugees, and of course, Blue Moon cameras. Enjoy. Well, hey there, and welcome to show 27 of the Lensless Podcast. No Corey this week, once again, but I am joined by a very special guest, Zeb Andrews, who hopefully can hear me.
I can hear you this time, Andrew.
Shush, don't give away all our secrets. People think this is a seamless show with no faults. So, well, Corey's unfortunately sends his apologies, dear listeners. He's still suffering the after effects of Hurricane... I've forgotten the name of it now. What was it?
I believe it's Florence.
Florence, that's it, yes. So he's had his electricity disconnected by the wind for about a week now, I guess. Fortunately, I think it's cooled down quite a bit, so he's not suffering with the heat. But he says he's surviving, and I think he's got some cans of Foster's tucked away somewhere. So you don't suffer. You didn't suffer from Hurricane Florence right up there in the Pacific Northwest, Zeb.
No, we have a continent buffering us from the effects of that storm.
Yeah. How long would it take to drive? I'll introduce you properly in a minute, but you can pretend to be Corey, okay? Because normally I have a bit of banter with Corey. How long does it take you to drive from North Carolina to Portland, Oregon?
Well, that depends. Are you a photographer or not?
Yeah, that's a great road trip, isn't it?
I could easily make that last months, but I suppose you could probably do it in a week or so.
So as a crow, how long does it take an aircraft to fly then from North Carolina to? Is it a few hours?
More than a few.
Really?
I don't know, 6-8 hours.
Wow.
I've never done the flight, so
that's crazy.
Someone can call it and correct me on you know, my specialty is photography, not aviation.
Well, geography.
Yeah.
Wow, that's just crazy. Well, I mustn't be too hard on you about geography, Zeb, because at least you have a passport, which is more than Corey Cannon has.
I do have a passport, and I know how to use it. So
we can throw Corey under the bus because he's 2 weeks in a row, leaving me to do it all. There's a bit much, really.
Not to cast any aspersions on Corey, but it boggles my mind a little bit. One of my coworkers, we recently traveled to Europe for the first time in his life, and I'm like, "You're in your 30s," and that just seems like. I'm very passionate about traveling, and I couldn't imagine not having a passport and such.
Quite right. I've been to the States a few times now, and everybody I've met, to be truthful, has been lovely and welcoming and warm. And some of them have had passports and some haven't, I guess, but they've all been lovely. The world view of folks does change a bit once you travel, though, doesn't it, I have to say?
It's very interesting getting out of your bubble and seeing just like how different parts of the world can be, but at the same time, in other ways, how similar people around the world can be too. It is very, I think, eye-opening, and it's a heck of a lot of fun to photograph.
It is, yeah, but if I lived in the States, I'm not sure whether I'd have a passport, you know, I have to admit it, because I think I'd spend every summer just doing long road trips with an Airstream. How about that? Have you got an Airstream? You must have a big silver Airstream.
I don't have an Airstream. Seems like I should, and yeah, then I'd probably turn it into a giant pinhole camera or something crazy like that, but... it is there's a lot to see here in the States, and you could spend a lifetime exploring all of that without ever leaving the country.
You really could. I'm a great America lover. And many of my UK friends say, oh, I wouldn't want to go to America. Don't like America. I said, well, how can you generalize? You know, it's just bonkers.
It's a pretty wide-ranging group. I was going to say, you know, I've lived my whole life in the Pacific Northwest. So, and it's like, that's one of the nice things I like about traveling too, is it's a great way to remind myself how much I enjoy living in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. Well, my next trip to America, and it'll probably be a few years away because we haven't got the funds these days, will be to the Pacific Northwest. All my pinhole friends I'm now meeting on the podcast, they've all offered to put us up, me and my wife, for a night or two, so I can now add you to the list. We're going out to see Lorraine Healy, who lives on an island somewhere off Washington State, I think.
Whidbey Island. Yeah. I was just up there the weekend before last, in fact, but I didn't meet up with Lorraine.
Oh, didn't you go and turn up on a doorstep? That's what I've threatened.
No, I didn't even tell her I was going to be up there. It slipped my mind, and now she's probably going to hear this on the podcast and be angry at me for not letting her know that I was in her neck of the woods.
Yeah, you hear that, Lorraine? Yeah. She's a lovely lady, and I can't wait to meet her and all my new podcast friends. Anyway, let's introduce our special guest, shall we, Zeb?
Sure, go for it, Andrew.
So we're joined this week by Zeb Andrews, who is doing a live outside broadcast while he makes an exposure. That sounds really dodgy, doesn't it? You're not wearing a Macintosh, are you, or anything? He's making an exposure with his camera. But not pinhole. Is that right, Seb?
No. Today it's the Hasselblad. One of the Hasselblads, anyway.
But you've got that flex body thing on it, have you?
Yeah. I mean, funny enough, I don't yet own a pinhole camera with filter threads. All my pinholes are filterless, so I wouldn't be able to, you know, I figured, well, if I'm going to be standing around talking for an hour, and no offense, I enjoy standing around talking for an hour, it's like, I might as well make a picture while I'm at it. And so that requires some pretty heavy filtration. And so, yeah, I got the flex body set up with a crazy tilt applied to it and pointing directly at the sun and 18 or 19 stops of neutral density filtration going. So it probably won't work, but if it doesn't work, this will be the only time you ever hear about it.
Yeah, I occasionally say, I mean, just recently I said, oh, I'm out shooting paper negatives this week. And I was, because James Guerin sent me an 8x10 camera.
The prototype. I saw that.
Yeah. And I've put a couple of sheets of paper in, and I've been too embarrassed to share the results so far.
Well, I mean,
so I've kept quiet about it, but I've been trying to figure out what I need to do. I think it's to do with the, as James said, it gets quite a lot of light loss between the middle and the outside. But other folks use paper, so I don't know. I was shooting in a very overcast, not overcast, in a very bright sunny day, and I think I need to go out again when it's a bit, when the contrast range isn't so great, and maybe it stands a better chance. I don't know. Have you shot many paper negatives?
A bit, yeah, and I've taught classes using the old cardboard box pinhole with either paper negative or paper positive, and yeah, that stuff can be pretty high contrast. Have you looked into like pre-flashing the paper at all?
Well, I'm using this is darkroom paper. It's not the direct positive stuff. I understand from reading about direct positive that pre-flashing helps. With darkroom paper, I'm very familiar with flashing darkroom paper, because I use it occasionally where I can't get any tonality in the highlights, and that, you know, that's a technique in darkroom work, as you no doubt know, where you're encouraging the paper to get over its inertia for exposure, and so it needs less in the highlights to record some image detail. And would that be the same if I stuck darkroom paper in a pinhole camera? You'd pre-flash that as well, would you?
To be honest, I've never tried it. But, I mean, whether you're exposing that paper via an enlarger or a pinhole in a box, I would
still light, isn't it?
Yeah, it's still light. Or, yeah, you know, you just wait a month, and I'm sure you guys will be socked in with with nice overcast weather. That should make that a bit easier as well.
Funnily enough, my darkroom days are normally in the middle of the summer, and when I tell people that, they say, well, what are you doing in the summer? You should be out in that lovely weather. And I said, do you know what? It's far too sunny, and it's too much like hard work. I'm having to control I'm trying to get detail in the shadows, detail in the highlights. I know you don't have to, but that's what I'm aiming for, you know. And boy, if you've only got 4 or 5 stops between the shadow where you want detail and the highlights, that's much easier to capture on film and print in any way I want. That gives me a nice flexible negative. So none of this photographing in sunshine.
Photography does that to you. I think that it's one of the best cures for seasonal affective disorder. It's like, it gives you a whole newfound appreciation for overcast. We joke at work that, you know, like some photographers spend thousands of dollars to get the light in their studios, that here in Portland, we get 6 months out of the year for free.
Yeah, we get that kind of light as well. And the trouble is, I never see any sunshine, because in the summer, I'm in the darkroom, and in the winter, I'm out taking pictures. So that was, I just have to take a pill to restore the vitamin I don't know what it is, D or K. Anyway, enough of my wittering. Zeb, while you're getting funny looks from passers-by and talking to yourself while exposing, why don't you take a little bit of time to just fill me and the listeners in about your journey into photography, how you morphed into Pinhole?
Oh, wow.
And I'll try and be quiet.
That's all right. Feel free to steer me, because
I will do. Don't worry.
I'll have to give you the condensed version, because the long version's taken, well, gosh, the long version's taken 16 or 17 years to get here, and we don't have quite that much time. But no, I got into photography back in early 2002, and it really just, you know, it kind of came out of nowhere for me. I was one of those people that just like was minding my own business and got blindsided by the photography bug just completely out of left field one day. Like, I'd never taken any classes or anything. In fact, I was going to school to be a teacher, and had just graduated and got my degree in history, and was trying to figure out whether I was going to travel abroad to teach English as a second language for a while, just to do something fun, or apply for the graduate teaching program. And mm-hmm. And then one day I stumbled through the door of this photography store that had just opened up in my neighborhood, and the weird owner of the store ended up selling me my first camera, which was a Nikon FM2, which I still have and still use. And I've abused that poor thing in the worst possible ways, but it keeps making pictures. And so that's where I got my humble start. And within a year, I was working at that same camera shop that itself had only opened in December of 2001. And that's Blue Moon Camera and Machine.
Yep.
Opened, you know, right at the leading wave of the digital revolution, when everybody was dumping their film cameras. And here comes this fellow, my boss, Jake, and he's like, you know, it'd be a great idea opening a film camera store when everybody wants digital cameras.
Well, so he was either, he at the time, he was either going to be a fool or he was going to be a visionary, wasn't he?
No comment. But no, what he had was passion and like a completely unshakable belief that no matter how many, you know, even if the majority of people didn't realize what they were kind of giving up, he was going to keep the light burning and eventually remind people. And that's what Blue Moon's, you know, like gosh, now what? We've been there for 17 years or so, and it has been a pretty amazing journey. But getting back to me, I picked up my first pinhole camera in 2004.
Yeah.
So just a couple of years later, and that was a zero image 2000.
Me too. Do you know? I think my zero image 2000, I would have picked up in, maybe a little bit earlier than that, but certainly a good chunk of years ago. Yeah, over 10 anyway. But anyway, sorry. Yeah. Carry on.
Oh yeah, no, that's quite all right. That was and at that time. I don't remember a terrible variety of options. I mean, there was zero image. There was eight banner was still around.
Yep.
There was the Leonardo in large format. And I don't even remember how we found this camera, but we actually, Jake and I went in together to get it as a gift for one of our coworkers who was really into Holga and all sorts of other quirky, she just liked anything quirky when it came to photography. So we were like, okay, what kind of like weird camera can we throw at her? And I think Jake found it, on a website somewhere or something. He's like, how about one of these? And so we got that for her. It was going to be a birthday gift. And then tragically enough, she ended up being killed in a car accident.
Oh dear Lord.
Yeah, before we were ever able to give her the camera.
Oh, Seb, goodness me.
Yeah, sorry to take a heavier turn, but then, so like Jake and I kept this camera and we turned it into the, you know, her name was Josie Peterson, so we dubbed it the Josie Peterson Memorial Pinhole.
And what a lovely...
Him and I, yeah, and so him and I took turns taking it out and using it and sharing it and making pictures with it and he still has that camera. It's pretty worn and weathered over the years. And I eventually, the first zero image that I bought for myself then, well, I get a little bit ahead of myself. We fell in love with the camera. The zero image 2000 is darn near a perfect camera. And I hope that Zerniki listens to your podcast. And that's still over the years, hands down my favorite pinhole camera I've ever held. And so we started carrying them. We're like, gosh, we love this camera. And so we started stocking them at Blue Moon. And then my first camera that I owned myself then was a zero image 6x9 because I figured, well, I'll have access to the 6x6 version whenever I want. So I bought the 6x9 just to give myself the options. And gosh, that was the top of a slippery slope.
Did you, when you first saw that pinhole camera, did you have a notion of what pinhole image making was, you know, due to its history? Because it's, you know, it's been around a while, hasn't it? From artists' use. And then in high school, you know, a lot of kids make pinhole cameras. Did you ever do that?
Oh yeah, I know that was my first experience. I mean, again, like I came into photography as I knew nothing. Like the very first camera I ever, the very first quote unquote real camera I ever used was a Pentax K1000, and at the time I didn't even understand what the dang aperture ring was all about. Like. It was explained to me, and eventually I just had to settle on, okay, I rotate the ring one way and the needle goes up, and I rotate the ring the other way and the meter needle goes down. So that's where I started, right? So
you gave up and just moved on to pinholes.
Well, I learned this stuff pretty quick, but yeah. I just had no background. So I have pretty humble beginnings there. The zero image was my first experience with pinhole. Like you can take a wooden box and poke a hole in it and make images. Like what? And then, you know, thanks to the internet and some you know, whatever it was back in the day, Google or Ask Jeeves or what have you. Some internet searches, I came across the work of Eric Renner and then your recent guest, Justin Quinnell, whose whole series of, like, at the time, like, one of the more recent bodies of work he'd done was that whole series with the 110 pinhole in his mouth. And I'm like, oh my God, this stuff is, like, awesome. And that guy must be crazy, but it's awesome.
I'm really hoping to meet Justin. He's doing some work out close to where I live in Cambridge, the proper Cambridge, you understand, not your knockoff one in America. But so he's doing some workshops or teaching here at some point. So I've told him to look me up, and I don't know whether I'm scared or looking forward to meeting him. But
you should probably be both. but after, that was a great episode. I loved hearing him. That was really cool to that you had him on.
You just have to wind him up and set him off, don't you? It's brilliant.
It is pretty brilliant, and he's pretty brilliant too. And so, yeah, that was like one of my first. He was one of my first, like, kind of like, here's an example of what you can do with pinhole photography. And then the rest was just like, you know, the world was pretty wide. The photographic world was pretty wide open for me at the time. And so, like, and I had, like, and I still do, an insatiable curiosity. So, like, all right, what can we do with this thing? And I spent a lot of time out there making, you know, burning a lot of film through that camera. And now I have, like, 10 of them or something like that. It's awful.
10 zeros or 10 pinhole cameras?
No, 10 various pinhole cameras. I only have the 2 zeros. Well, I have the 6x9 and then a 2000.
Yeah.
I have the reality. I have like 3 reality, so subtle 6x6 ones. James was nice enough to send me, he sent me when he first started into it, he sent me the 6x17. And so I have one of the early ones when he still made those in wood.
Yeah,
that's a pretty camera.
I have the 6x12. I have James's 6x12 with the 2 pinholes, and then I have his 6x6 with the filter ring.
Yes, yeah. At some point, I'm going to pick up either a zero image or a reality so subtle with the filter ring.
Can't you carry
them both?
Can't you get an adapter to fit on your 6x9? I've seen somebody shooting in the Flickr group. I have to apologize. I can't remember who it is. But with a lovely zero image, 6x9 with a filter ring.
Yeah, you can buy the filter thread adapters separate from zero image, or, like, you know, like,
or glue something on.
or just plenty of gaffer's tape. That always does the trick too, but it's not as pretty.
It seems a shame when you have such a pretty camera to start, you know, doing bodge things to it, like sticking tape on it, doesn't it? It's too pretty, the zero image camera. It's a lovely camera, and I have one.
It is a really pretty camera,
but it's too pretty.
Well, not after you've been using it for a few years.
Yeah, no, mine's pretty battered. Here, you never guess where mine's gone again.
Oh, why don't you tell me?
Did you? I don't know if you followed the story about I lent both my pinhole cameras to Neil Piper.
Neil.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And he's
did you get it back?
I did. I got both back.
Oh, good for Neil.
I've sent him. He's now got my zero again as of yesterday, because he's ordered a 6x6 from James, but it's not shipped in time for him to go to the Eden Project down in Cornwall. The Eden Project is a series of biodomes where you can go in and experience different climates, and so he wanted to take a square pinhole camera with him. And so I sent it back to him again, and he's, you know, that's okay. I told him he couldn't have my reality because I use that too much, but he's got the zero.
Well, it seems like it's not like you're hurting for pinhole cameras either, Andrew. I have a feeling that you have more than a couple.
Shh, be quiet.
To spare.
Don't say that. Yeah. So, what really drives you when you're out making images, Zeb. You mentioned your innate curiosity. Now, I don't feel like I'm psychoanalyzing you, but I am a bit in my amateurish way. So is it an innate curiosity for the world around you, or is it just that you like making pretty pictures?
Or both?
Or something else.
Or something else, you know, D, all and none of the above.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's, you know, to be honest, that's a question I've tried to define the answer to for, gosh, almost as long as, you know, if we're going to talk Pinhole specifically, one of the big things that attracted me to Pinhole photography was that it slowed me down. Like, I got into photography and I jumped in like both feet right into the deep end, and so I was like, I was really pursuing it very enthusiastically and very passionately, but then living in the Northwest and amongst all this beautiful landscape, I really enjoyed hiking even before I got into photography. But then I started to notice, like, I was hiking to all these beautiful places and spending all my time, you know, frantically running around trying to figure out how to photograph them. And it kind of felt like photography was getting a little bit in the way of, like, why I was just going out there. And so then enter the Pinhole, and I have this really simple camera that, you know, I'm not going to get drawn into like dials or menus and you know, it's just kind of set it up and point it and start making exposure. But even better yet, I get out under like the tree cover in the gorge on an overcast day, and I easily have like 4, 8, 15 minute exposures. And so I could just set the camera up and then just like kind of sit there and sort of take things in for several minutes and just kind of enjoy the scenery and such.
I think that's we're getting all the background noises. Have you got a helicopter
going
over?
Yes. There's a train going by.
Oh, is that what that noise was?
Now there's also a helicopter coming in. So it's like it's you know, welcome to, you know, city life. But we'll give the helicopter a moment.
No, it's okay. I love it. I want to come back to photographing the landscape with the Pinhole camera, but you just now got me on the subject of American trains, because I remember driving through Arizona probably, and we passed this train, and we started counting the number of wagons on it, and there was over 100, and they were piled two on top of each other, and it was just the most incredible thing.
It's pretty impressive, and you think about, not to get into the physics of all that, but just how much weight that is and what it takes to move that, and it is pretty incredible stuff. But so I think that's like, that was some of my early motivations. But I mean, like, I was also like really curious just about, like, because like the Pinhole camera, it would just show me glimpses from a world that I couldn't see with my own eyes, and I found that really fascinating, and that has been, I think, a common thread in like a lot of my photography. It's one of the things that like draws me to, like, say the flex body here, and the ability to bend the plane of focus and to record in ways that I can't see. And so like the camera is very kind of,
when I'm out with my large format 4x5 or 5x4, whichever way round it is, I either go for everything to be, get obsessed with everything being really sharp, or I just abandon all technique and do loads of weird, crazy stuff with the tilts and shifts, which is a bit kind of cliched in many ways, but I kind of like it, you know? I like being able to do weird things with the plane of focus and create something just a little bit different, which focuses your attention into different areas of the frame. And you'll be familiar with Isabel Curda's work.
The... You know, it's really good.
You familiar with Isabel's work, Zeb?
No, I can't say that I am.
Oh, you must look up Isabel. She,
How do you spell that last name?
C-U-R-D-E-S. I think it's pronounced Curdes. She's Danish.
Okay.
And she has, she's on most of the platforms. And she uses a Hasselblad flex body.
Quite a bit.
Yeah, no, look her up. I'm not sure she uses pinholes, but she kind of should do, really. I must have a chat with her.
Yeah, I was going to say, you should reach out and convert her.
Yeah. It's really interesting, your thoughts on the gear getting in the way, because I was photographing in Wales earlier in the summer with an RB67, and, you know, just the sheer effort of moving that thing around and then putting it on a tripod and composing it. I'm kind of missing things around me, you know, and you start to question, I think, like you say, you know, why are you in the landscape? Are you there just because of you want to make another picture, or are you there to contemplate the sheer majesty of this scene in front of you, or the wonder of the cornfield, you know? And at least with that pinhole camera, you're not having to peer through a viewfinder, you're not having to put a cloth over your head. You can do both. You can set that up and record a chunk of time whilst watching the skylarks, can't you?
Exactly.
If you have skylarks in America.
I'm sure somewhere, but not here.
Yeah, so that...
But,
that's...
I mean, there. I do think there is something to... I don't know quite how to articulate it, but I do think there is something to be said about, like, slowing down and putting more time into thinking about what you're doing and why you're doing it and developing, like, those thoughts or emotions. And I think that will ultimately, like, benefit the photography that comes out of it, because if you're running around just you know, as they say, spray and pray, you know, like, how much of yourself is invested in each one of those images, and then the results usually bear that out.
Zeb, I have a notebook that I've scribbled things in. My current photography notebook says, it's not what you look at that matters, it's what you see. And some clever person called Henry David Thoreau wrote that.
A very wise fellow, he.
And of course, it's about learning to see, isn't it? It's not looking at things, it's learning to see. It might have been Gary Winogrand. Winogrand, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
It might have been him who said, I photograph things to see what the world looks like photographed. I think it was him. I might be attributing that saying to somebody else.
I don't know for sure, but that sounds like a vaguely Gary Winogrand-ish.
Yes.
There's also the great story about he was leading a workshop one time, and his students noticed just how prolifically he was photographing, like, a roll of film per city block, and finally one of the students caught him between rolls and said, well, Gary, you know, with all the pictures you make, aren't you worried about the ones you're missing while you reload? And his response was, there are no pictures when I reload. And I've turned that one over quite a bit, because, you know, you can only photograph what you can see, and sight and perception are not purely biological functions. And yeah, that sort of gets down to, you know, one of my deeper motivations is, you know, like, I'm limited by my eyes, even if I did have perfect vision, which I don't.
You know? No, me neither. I'm terribly short-sighted, which is very, very, very useful as a large format photographer, because I don't need a loop. I just take my glasses off, and I can stick my nose about 2 inches from the glass and focus really well.
it's kind of useful as a pinhole photographer too, you know, like I want to pre-visualize what this will look like in pinhole. I just take my glasses off and there you go.
Well, look, we had one request from a listener, which you're aware of, the aforementioned Mr. Neil Piper of the glamorous Soot and Whitewash podcast. He was asking about your domesticity series, and you were laid up with a bad back, I think. And did you just get bored and thought, I'll document life around the house?
It's a good question, because it was like, it was several years ago. So like remembering the genesis of that project is tricky. Are you familiar with the work of Abelardo Morel? He's famous for doing the camera obscura photography. He has that whole amazing portfolio where he travels all around the world and turns like hotel rooms and offices and abandoned closets into camera obscuras and photographs.
I almost certainly am, but being a bit of an ignoramus, I've not linked the two together. So do you know how to spell that?
Abelardo.
Abelardo. Morel.
Abelardo. And then I believe his last name's two R's, two L's. So I think it's Morrell.
I'll dig out the details and put a note in the show notes at the end anyway. But yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, one of his, I think, lesser celebrated portfolios, he did a whole series of photos where he just kind of crawled around his house and photographed everything from like the perspective of his 3-year-old or 4-year-old son.
Yeah.
And I think I'd seen that at that point, and that was something that stuck with me. And so, yeah, I hurt my back on, you know, out hiking, out hiking and doing photography, carrying an overly large backpack with too much gear in it. And
you should have just had a pinhole camera, shouldn't you? That's, you know.
Well, I'm sure I did. it was all the other cameras that caused the issues. I had a pretty good bout of sciatica, which if you've never experienced trouble with your sciatic nerve, I can tell you from great experience, don't bother. It's no fun.
I think it's one of those things where you just don't know where to put yourself to, you, whatever position you get into is just
the floor.
Difficult.
That's where you put yourself. You put yourself on the floor, and that's kind of where you stay for a while. And so you start to
see the world from a different level, don't you? Like your 3-year-old child crawling along the carpet.
Yeah, that's part of it. But I mean, like for me, the biggest limitation that I was dealing with was just like, okay, like I can barely walk, let alone get out and hike, you know, like driving to the beach or out to the gorge, those things were out of the question. So like for me, it was a pretty stark choice. Like, okay, I can lay around the house and be miserable, or I can lay around the house and try and be creative. And I decided to opt for the latter, and it all started like just one day in like the laundry room, and I'm just standing there, and I don't even really know where the idea came from, but I was looking at the dryer, and I was like, huh, I wonder what the world looks like from inside the dryer looking out. And like, even on my best days, I'm not going to fit inside a dryer. So I just went and I grabbed the pinhole camera, and I think, you know, I chose the pinhole just because the dryer is a relatively confined space, and it was like the widest camera that I had in terms of field of view. But something about the pinhole also just felt kind of right. So set the camera up in the dryer. It was like a 4-minute exposure. I stood off to the side, so I wasn't in that frame. And that got the ball rolling, so to speak. I'm like, huh, well, that was interesting, you know? So like, okay, photograph the laundry room. I don't normally think of taking photo expeditions to my laundry room. So like, that was kind of fun. Let's expand this. And so I'm like, okay, let's turn this into a project where like, I'm going to take the dozens and dozens of things that I do every single day that I don't even really ever bother to think about doing, that I just kind of do on autopilot, and I'm going to try and like consciously think about each one of these and photograph them. And so then it became this really fun project to first sit down and like catalog, like, okay, what are all the things that I do every day without thinking about, you know, like showering, eating breakfast, eating lunch, doing the dishes, cooking dinner. And then those in turn became individual little like creative projects, like, okay, you know, like the very next photo I did after the laundry room was the, you know, the self-portrait of me in the shower. So I go from
I was just going to ask you about that one.
that was the very second one. It was like, so I go from an image that I'm not in at all to one where I'm, you know, in a very exposed situation. And yeah, I had to give that some thought, like, okay, how am I going to frame this? And like, what am I going to do during this exposure that's going to prevent me from getting like a not safe for family viewing rating on Flickr? And not to mention that, you know, I have like no voyeuristic tendencies myself. So it's like, I don't want to post a nude portrait of myself on Flickr, but nonetheless, you know, I want to make the picture because like this is something that I do every day and I don't ever think about photographing it. So like, I want to try and figure this out. And then, you know, the same with breakfast and lunch. And then once you get a couple of those in, you're like, okay, like, well, now I want to photograph lunch or dinner, but I don't want to do it in the same way that I photograph breakfast. You know, it's like, I don't want this to be rote. And so then I think for like the lunch image, I ended up taping the camera to the ceiling, pointing straight down. And you know, I made a couple different iterations of dinner. I have the one of the camera, you know, building on my success with the dryer. I was like, well, let's put the camera in the stove in the oven. And I really, really wanted the heating coils in that oven to be red, but there's just no way that, you know, you can put a wooden camera in a hot oven for 4 minutes and expect good things to happen.
Well, you need to get Todd Schlemmer to 3D print you one out of Kevlar or something.
Or asbestos.
Oh, asbestos, yeah.
I think I actually mentioned that when I originally posted that image to Flickr, and someone said, well, all you need to do is build an asbestos glove for your camera. And I'm thinking, great, you know, I'll get the shot and cancer. And it's like, so.
Yeah, well, you're okay with asbestos as long as you don't generate little fibers. If it's, you know, if the fibers are contained, you'll be good. That shower picture, Zeb, how did you mount that above the shower head?
I think I was probably like a lot of those images. I'm either using a Gorillapod or tape.
Yeah,
and those two things are very interchangeable. Like I couldn't have made like probably a quarter of the pinhole images I have made without a good roll of tape somewhere. But I'm pretty sure that was with the camera mounted on a Gorillapod, and you know, just as a little behind the scenes. Little bit of info, that was actually one, I think, of like three or four different takes I did on that. And so I had a couple where the camera was mounted above the shower head, and then I did a couple where the camera was mounted below the shower head.
Did some end up being explicit, and they're like the ones that you keep under the counter?
None of them turned out explicit. A couple were a bit more suggestive than I cared to have. But, you know, like one of the, and I think like I went with the one above the shower because I kind of like the below the shower because then you get the streams of water dropping through the frame. And I thought that was fun. But the bottom of my shower head looked kind of dingy and gross. And so it's like,
I was going to say your oven looked remarkably clean. I think I'd be too embarrassed to put my pinhole camera in our oven. You need to give that a good clean, brother.
Well, there was like, if you go onto my series on Flickr, there's one image I did inside the refrigerator looking out, and I eventually had to remake that image because the first version I just like I really really detested because it was just like like, it just had a bunch of gross food in it. And it's like, I don't want to keep looking at this with, like, the generic, like, pancake syrup bottle. And so, like, I eventually redid that shot with the fridge stocked with a much better array of foods. So
I was very complimentary on Justin, on the clean condition of Justin's teeth. They look very they look very white. Again, mine have got a bit of coffee stain on, so I'm not sure I'd want to be putting a 110 camera in my mouth, but maybe one day. Mm-hmm. On are you familiar with, do you follow Monica? I think her surname is Danos, Dr. Mars Rover.
Oh, not
that Monica.
That,
no, there's a few. Monica. There's a, yeah, you're thinking of Crafty Money, aren't you? From
yes, I am.
Dr. Mars Rover is up in Washington, I think, maybe Seattle. And
oh goodness, no.
Yeah, so she's got the lovely handle of Dr. Mars Rover. I don't know whether she is, but she's going to be on the show in November. We're planning to have an all-female November.
Oh, that's cool.
And Monica did a series. She runs something. She did a series called Housebound, which is very reminiscent of what you're doing. I think most of hers were in black and white. And when we get her on the show, we'll chat to her about it. But I think it was, she had something that was making her housebound. I don't know whether it was an illness or a physical injury. But she just did these series, and she was just contemplating things around her, you know. And they're very beautiful, black and white, no color, just very, very, just focusing on the shape and the tone of very ordinary things. And I think she found it very therapeutic, or I get the impression she did. But you should check her out, Dr. Mars Rover. I'll put a link in the show notes to her. But she's coming on. I think it'll be either the first or second week in November. And the other person who does a lot of photography around the house, and he even wrote a book about it, is Andrew Sanderson. I don't know if you're familiar with Andrew.
No, that's a new one for me as well.
Andrew's coming on the show at some point. He's a UK-based photographer and darkroom worker. He's actually used by Ilford to do a lot of masterclasses and things. So he's coming on the show. And he's been testing out Mike Walker's latest pinhole camera, because Mike Walker makes the Harman Titan pinhole cameras. And he's been testing out a 4x14, I think it is, pinhole camera.
Sounds like fun. Like flat plane or curved plane?
No, it's flat plane, but it's got a conical nose on it. Mike Walker, if you go into the Lensless Podcast Facebook group, there's a post about it from earlier today.
Okay.
And Andrew Sanderson has posted some test images. It seems to have fairly good, however he's designed it, it has good image coverage across the, you know, the back. There doesn't appear to be any light fall off. So that's we'll ask him about that when he comes on.
Yeah. You have to forgive me, because I have a very interesting relationship with social media. I get a lot of, like, I think it's a factor of working in a camera store. Like, I'm interacting with so many photographers on a daily basis. I'm just not as motivated to, like, spend time on social media, which is ironic to say, because I post so much, and also because I run the social media platform for Blue Moon as well.
But should we talk a little bit about Blue Moon? Because there's that chopper again.
There it
is. How's that hour-long exposure coming on?
What was that, Andrew?
How's that hour-long exposure coming on?
Oh, I just wrapped it up. It felt like it was about done. It wasn't really calculated for an hour. I think I calculated it 8 or 15 minutes, and then I threw on some extra time just for reciprocity and just because I could.
There's a few things I still love to talk to you about. One is Blue. We'll talk about Blue Moon cameras. I'd like to talk to you about your teaching, and then if we get time, I'd like to talk to you about your work with the Syrian refugee children. That sounded really interesting.
That was a very formative experience.
I know, but I said we're going to talk about Blue Moon, but should we start there with the, because that sounds, what I read about that, it seemed to have a remarkable effect on you, Zeb?
It would be difficult to participate in something like that without having a significant effect. But that was all thanks to Pinhole Photography. This was an organization that's based in California called the Karam Foundation. And
spell that for me, Zeb.
It's KARAM.
Yep.
And they're an organization of Syrian Americans, and so when the Syrian refugee crisis first started those several years ago, they were going into refugee camps on the Syrian side of the border and working in the refugee camps, but that became just too dangerous, and so they started to work with a school in southern Turkey, right on the border, literally right on the border, and working with the children in these schools who had experienced, you know, very traumatic events in their lives. And so they were, this Karam Foundation were running two trips a year, one during summer, one during winter, and they'd take a team of artists and athletic coaches that were using art and athletics to connect with the kids. And
how did you get involved? How did they get in touch with you, or did you get in touch with them? How was that connection made?
They found me. I'd been featured on a local art program on a station called Oregon Public Broadcasting, which is a local branch of NPR, I believe, or somehow affiliated. And they had done a short, like 10-minute study on me and my pinhole photography, and had me building a camera out of a Quaker oatmeal container and then making an exposure with it down under the St. John's Bridge here, and then taking it back up to Blue Moon and developing it in the dark room. And that had run, gosh, I don't know when that run had ran, 2007 or 2008 or something. And then at some point, OPB released it for like national syndication, so it was showing up on like it'd show up on like Ohio Public Broadcasting, or I suppose California Public Broadcasting, and one of the founders of the Karam Foundation had, you know, either discovered it online or saw it on TV or so, and so she reached out to me and sent me an email, and it was one of those like weird out of the blue emails where, like, it's like, at first I was like, is this for real? And you know, because the email was like, dear so and so, you know, saw your work, and I'm the head of this nonprofit foundation that teaches, you know, art and athletics to Syrian refugee children, and there was like a cynical part of me is like, okay, when are they going to ask for like my bank account number?
I have a Nigerian bank account. You need to send money to.
Right, but they had links to press that they had received, and I did some research and got back in touch, and they explained what they were about and that they were hoping that I could be a part of their next trip and to teach like pinhole photography as one of the artistic classes, and I said sure, and it was a completely volunteer thing. Like I had to raise my own funds to pay for all my travel and supplies, and so I did that through, gosh, I believe a Kickstarter campaign, and then that was June 2014. Went and spent was there for I think about 4 days in southern Turkey, and just did.
Were these children these children who had lost parents, or
some of them?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. And they ranged in age from like kindergarten through about 11th grade. Some of them had at this point been out of school for as much as 2 years because of just like what they were going through. Some of them had lost parents. Some of them had witnessed losing parents.
But it's still going on, isn't it? Still going on.
It's still going on. And like the amazing thing was like the teachers at the school were themselves Syrian refugees. And so they were dealing with their own trauma at the same time they were trying to teach these children and help them deal with their trauma. And it was just such an amazing, like the kids were incredible. They were so like warm and welcoming and enthusiastic, and they loved the program. And but at the same time, you could see like some of the scars. So I made pinhole cameras, and then I had, you know, this idea that we just turn, like, just build a little makeshift darkroom there in the basement of the school itself, so then the kids could like watch me process their paper negatives. Or I think at the time, I was actually, I think for that project, actually, we used paper positives. So they were getting positives out of their cameras. And yeah, some of the kids would not go into the darkroom just because they were too scared by it.
Oh boy, 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 yeah. You just weren't expecting that, were you?
No, but I mean, I didn't know honestly what to expect. That was like so far outside of the realm of anything I'd ever experienced that I didn't know. I it was pretty eye-opening, and it was pretty perspective altering, and it also taught me that like there's a lot more to like photography than just making pretty pictures, like the skills and the experience and the enthusiasms they can have other effects or be used for other purposes.
You don't know what seeds you've planted in those young minds, do you, really? You don't know how those seeds will take fruit in the future.
That's true. And I mean, you hope, you know, and that's one of the reasons you do it, is you hope that it maybe you will plant a couple of seeds and create some ripples and maybe slightly change the trajectory of a young kid's life in a positive direction.
How long were you out there for, Zeb?
About 4 days. And then I spent another 3 or 4 days in Istanbul before coming home to just kind of like decompress from that whole situation.
Yeah, it's a great contrast from, you know, the worst excesses of America to that, isn't it? You know, in Turkish refugee camp.
That was like coming back. That was one of the things that was, it was difficult to adjust to, was sometimes how hung up we get on our little daily dramas. And here I knew about this school, about these and what these kids had gone through, and I'm like, it gave me, I had trouble having much patience for some of the drama that we sometimes find ourselves engaging in on a daily basis.
Yeah, but that, you know, that those people who are getting dramatic over, you know, what appears to be the most trivial, it's all relative, isn't it? You know, their life experiences probably haven't taken them to see kindergarten kids who've seen their parents get blown up in front of their eyes.
And that's all true. It is relative, and that's why, you know, having an
have you kept in touch
experience like that.
Have you kept in touch with either the organization or, you know, the camps? What's happened to those refugee camps? Are they still in existence or what?
I have not kept in touch with the school, but I've kept in touch with some of the other instructors that I taught with, and I keep I keep telling myself that I'm going to get back involved with them at some point, and then the next thing you know, it's 2, 3, 4 years later. But yeah, that's still out there on my radar, and they're still working at it. They set up a more permanent school and stocked it with better equipment so that the school for these children has like an actual computer lab and okay, such. And yeah, I've been kicking around a couple of other ideas related to this, but I haven't brought any of them. I haven't got the ball rolling on any yet. I was toying with the idea for a while of leading a photojournalistic style workshop over in some of the refugee camps in Greece to teach some of the refugees over there the skills they need to sort of document and tell their own stories, as opposed to the stories largely being conveyed through outside journalists. And so there's...
Would that be a pinhole approach? Because there's no reason why it couldn't be.
it certainly could be. I did not conceive of it as a like pinhole photojournalism.
Yeah.
You're taking that to a whole other level there, Andrew.
Well, why not? I don't.
Why not? Indeed.
There's one of our we like to call them a sister podcast, Negative Positives podcast. I don't know if you listen to that with Mike Gutterman and Andre Dominguez. Young Andre is in his last semester at college studying photography, and he's doing photojournalism using his Zero 6x9 camera. How about that?
That's awesome.
Yep.
Where there's a will, there's a way.
Absolutely.
Right?
No, I think there's lots of if you just put a different head on and think about things differently, I think he's onto something.
I'm going to have to check his work out, because I think that's just too cool.
Oh, he's at the beginning of the project, yeah, and he only has 9 photographs on Instagram. But if you
got to start somewhere.
If you hook up with the Negative Positives podcast, and they have a Facebook group, then you'll find Andre in there and strike up a conversation and ask him about it. Yeah,
I will indeed.
Now you do a bit of teaching, don't you?
Yeah. Not as much as I used to, but I still do. There used to be a great organization here in Portland called New Space, and I was teaching 2 or 3 classes a term there, mostly not pinhole photography, mostly just like beginning photography, which is a great topic to teach. Nothing like having students who are new to it and are fresh and excited and haven't yet been contaminated by learning all the things they're theoretically not supposed to do. But that place closed a year ago. And so that was where I was doing most of my teaching. But after they closed, a local arts college asked me to join their community education faculty.
And so, okay.
I still teach through them. That's been a bit of an uphill battle, just because their CE program, I get the sense it atrophied a bit, and so like they're struggling with enrollment, and they're trying to revitalize it. So that's been a bit of a struggle, but I do still do the occasional, you know, like I was up on Whidbey Island in Lorraine's territory.
That's Lorraine Healy, who you didn't tell you were going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and in my defense, it was kind of a whirlwind weekend. I went up there to teach a 2-day workshop on nighttime photography at a local arts college. And so most of my time was spent either driving up or back or teaching. So yeah, I did that as well, and I teach the occasional pinhole workshop or the occasional Holga workshop.
Is that through? Do you run any of those workshops through Blue Moon Cameras? Because that's always a good way to encourage people to buy more stuff, isn't it? Show them all the lovely cameras they can use, pinhole cameras.
You know, we taught we taught some photography workshops early on, and then we sort of stopped doing it just because it was really just a bandwidth issue. Like, you know, the labors and energies involved in running a small business like that were, it just seemed like the workshop angle was a bit of a bridge too far. But we did a few, and you know, if someone ever asked me if I want to do like a solo one-on-one workshop, I am always happy to work out the details with them, because I do enjoy my teaching. It's a lot of fun, but it's also it's hard work. And you know, to take a bit, you know, the way I look at it is like you're taking a bit of like that fire that's burning in you, and then you're trying to pass that on, and it can leave you feeling a bit drained if you're, you know, really going all at it. But it is, you know, it's also very rewarding, because I run into students even years later who took classes from me, and they've built careers or such, or
there you go.
They share pictures with me, and I'm like, oh my goodness, how did you make that? So
let's finish off by just talking a little bit about Blue Moon cameras, because we can't have you on here and not talk about Blue Moon camera and machine. Now, I think I first heard about Blue Moon camera and machine in 2000, and I'm going to say 11, when I was recovering from detached retina surgery, and I had to stay at home for a few weeks, and I started listening to the film photography podcast, the FPP, and they mentioned they mentioned Blue Moon cameras, and I shouldn't have gone on the website, because I could barely open my eye, but I did. And I think, I'm sure at the time you were stocking a lot of sort of 127 type films and things like that. I'm sure that was you.
Mm-hmm. We still do, in fact. We just got restocked on the 127, the Rearapan, the new Rearapan 400 black and white that replaced the discontinued 100.
Well, is it discontinued? I was talking to who was I talking to? Oh, I think I was chatting with M from Emulsive online, and he wasn't sure whether it was discontinued. I still have probably 20 rolls of Rearapan 100 in my fridge. And I saw that the 400 was starting to make an appearance.
Well, lucky you. Everything that I've heard implies that it's discontinued.
Yeah.
The company that makes it in Japan, they only distribute through in North America through Freestyle Photo in California. And so I sort of take Freestyles.
I bought them. I went onto eBay.com. And this would have been 3 or 4 years ago, and they were selling them direct. And I was, at the time, I was buying 10 rolls for about £60. So it was, you can do that conversion, but you know, it was pretty reasonable, you know, for something that was a bespoke product, really. And while they were offering those batches, I just bought a load, and I've probably shot 30 rolls of it, and I've still got 20 left. And I, I love that stuff, and I love shooting it in my little Yashica 44. You know, the
you have a baby Yashica.
Yeah, that's great. Love that.
Those are wonderful little cameras. Well, so yeah, Freestyles told me that the 100's been discontinued, and it was, you know, recently replaced with the 400.
I follow the Japanese guys on Twitter, but it's all in Japanese. There is, if you can work it out, I did follow a link to their direct site where they were selling stuff, and it was all in yen. I'd never have done the conversion, but I think you can probably follow the links and buy direct from them still.
Yeah, I reached out to them once just on behalf of Blue Moon, and they wouldn't wholesale to us. They just wanted to stay with Freestyle, which I can understand. But to be fair, I haven't contacted them directly to learn about if Rearapan 100 is completely gone or gone for good, or
no,
just
I'm not
wholesaled.
Sure.
Or
I'm not sure. You can still buy. There's one or two UK distributors over here. nick and trick photography, I think, stock it. But it's getting expensive now, so I'll just wait and see. I've got quite a few I can still use. This Blue Moon camera, though, mate, it's like an analog heaven, isn't it? That's what I can see.
It really is. It's a bit of an oasis for film photography is another way to think about it. It's a really cool place. It's especially if you're a film photographer to work in. And I've told people that like so much of my development as a photographer is tied up with my work there at Blue Moon and just because like you work 40 or 45 or 50 hours a week up to your ears in film photography and you just learn so much by immersion. But yeah, we do pretty much like if it's film related, we do it. So like we in-house process C41, black and white, E6. We still have a traditional wet dark room, and we're doing silver gelatin custom black and white printing. Both of our mini lab machines are true optical printers and not digital printers. So we're making analog prints from film.
I think Ilford still have an optical process machine. I'm sure they do.
I'm pretty sure they do as well. And then let's see what else. Lately we've been we recently started processing C22.
Now I saw that. Yes, I saw that on your I think it was something on your website about that. Using a Yashica Mat 124G.
I found some old rolls of what was it, Ektacolor Type S or whatever, expired somewhere in the 1960s or early 70s, and that'd been stored in our attic. And so I shot a few of those. And
I'd never heard of C22 process, so I still don't know much about that.
It's essentially just the precursor to C41. It was discontinued in 1970, over the course of like 72, 73, and replaced with the C41 process. Okay. So, yeah, without getting into the really nitty-gritty specifics, it was just the color negative process that existed before C41, except you can't run C22 film through the modern C41 process for a couple of reasons. It just ruins the film and makes a big mess of the machine that it goes in.
It's not like a funky cross-process trick, then. You just destroy the film.
you destroy the film, and you make a really bad mess of the film processor itself. So,
well, I'd encourage, you know, I wish so badly that we had the kind of stores that you have in the States, in the UK. You know, we have some pretty good outlets, but no way you can really go and hang out in quite the same way. I was in Atlanta last year, and a friend took us to Wings Cameras, and Wings Cameras in an old mum and pop store, and it's just delightful. But it doesn't have the range of stuff that your Blue Moon cameras does. Typewriters as well. I can't let you go, and I will let you go in a minute because this show's running on a bit for us. Typewriters. Now I have a typewriter. It's not a terribly. It's a refurbished typewriter. There's a man in the Midlands of the UK called Mr. Typewriter, and he refurbishes them. And I just have a fairly basic camera. Typewriter, a Silver Reed Silverette 2, and it's been refurbished, and I use it as part of my photography. So I'm making road trip prints of my American trips, and using my notebook to jog my memory, I'm typing up my journal. So doing a bit of typewriting, typewritten notes, handwritten maps of where I drove through the Grand Canyon or, you know, Route 66, and type notes. And I love it. You know, my daughter came home from university at Christmas time and I was typing. She said, "You're a proper hipster, aren't you now?"
Yeah. Well, that's awesome, Andrew. I'm really, yeah, like the typewriters, is again the owner of the store, Jake. The typewriters is purely his thing. He's loved typewriters. I mean, he was born about 50 years too late. Writing and literature are one of his big passions outside of photography, and he likes to do all of his personal writing on a typewriter. So when he opened up Blue Moon Camera, he saw it as an excellent opportunity to indulge himself on this fancy. But you know, we sell a surprising number of typewriters. We bring them in. We're lucky enough to be like half a mile down the street from like a full service typewriter repair shop. Yeah.
Now, the people who come in, do they all have beards and got tight trousers?
Not all of them. I mean, definitely some. It's Portland, after all, and it's analog photography and it's typewriters. We definitely do attract certain crowds, but the crowd at Blue Moon is a pretty awesome crowd. I mean, we have so many good customers and so many good customers that over the years have really kind of blurred the line between friend and customer. Like, which one are you? It's like,
What I might get you to do afterwards, we won't chat much longer because of the time, is to email me a few folk, because Diane Peterson has done this and others have been on the show. They said, hey, why don't you get, in fact, I think it was one of those guys who said, why don't you, must get Zeb on, you know? And, you know, you were on our radar anyway, but if you've got pinhole folks who you think would be really interesting for us to talk to, like this kind of chat, you know, just give me their details and I'll hit them up.
Totally. Yeah, I was thinking of that before I came onto the show and you know, trying to think of suggestions I would make that weren't redundant with ones that have already been made and who I would recommend. But I think my number one is a fellow by the name of Buzzy Sullivan, who...
Oh, no, I've not certainly not reached out to him. I'd remember that.
Oh, you would have a difficult time. Like, I would be a little surprised if he was on your radar. He doesn't just because he doesn't have a terribly big online presence, but he is one of the most... He's one of those guys that every time he would come into the shop, he would show me something photographically that, here comes the helicopter again, that would just like blow my mind. And he was doing some really cool stuff with pinhole for a while. He would do things where he was like shooting paper negative, but he would wad the paper up and crumple it up before putting it in the camera and then expose onto it. When it was all like folded and crumpled up, and get these really interesting effects, and then he went off to get his master's, I believe at Arizona State, where he's now teaching, and he does a lot of wet plate work out in the deserts there.
Wow, is he still pinholing then, or was that just a phase he went through?
I don't think he does a ton, but then again, I don't see, now that he's down in Arizona, I don't see a lot of the,
Okay, well, that's Buzzy. Nobody's
Buzzy,
called Buzzy,
yeah.
Are they really? He wasn't christened Buzzy, was he?
No, it's...
His name's Philip or something.
I'm not going to give away his real name, I'll let him do that if he wants, but I'll link you up with him.
That'll be good.
He's one of the coolest dudes that I know, and
we only
a good photographer.
Mate, we only have cool dudes on this show. You know, we don't let any old riffraff on.
Well, then that will fit the criteria perfectly.
Zeb, look, it's been a real, real pleasure, and we haven't missed Corey at all, have we? I'm not sure we'll have him back.
Oh. Corey, we've missed you. It's like, but Andrew, you did carry on valiantly in
with Cesare last week.
Yeah. Well, with him too, but
or
yeah, in Corey's absence,
okay.
Thank you so much.
You've
carried the load quite well.
Well, I can Corey does have to tell me to shut up sometimes. So I'm very conscious of letting the guests talk. So I've tried to do it with you, and you've been a lovely guest. So we normally ask people just to give a bit of a shout out as to where they can find your work. So do you want to do that for yourself, Zeb?
Well, so let's start by giving the shout out to Flickr. And Andrew, I have to give you props for always beating the Flickr drum. I know Flickr isn't like the hippest platform.
It is. It is, because we're on it.
I think it's still an amazing platform, and every time I get online to ask Google some question about like how should I develop this roll of film, I'm directed to back Flickr. To like a Flickr thread, right? And like there's just so much like good info on that site, and so Flickr is like where I prefer to post, and I usually post an image a day and try and write something generally regarding my thoughts on that image.
Yeah, that's what I've noticed about you on Flickr in particular. You're not alone, but you do, there's words and images go together very well on Flickr, and you do that. And I thoroughly recommend folk to check out Zeb's work on Flickr. Are you just remind me, are you on there as Zeb Andrews, or is it?
Yep, just Zeb Andrews.
Because Lens optional is Instagram, isn't it?
That's Instagram.
Yeah.
And I use Instagram, and I like it for what it is, but it's so ephemeral that I have trouble like putting much faith in like the staying power of anything I do on that platform. But yeah, you can find me on Instagram as well, Lens Optional. So that's just Lens_optional. Of course, I have multiple Instagram accounts,
Yes, I found you on. I think I follow you under Zeb's Camera as well. That's just your
phone of. You're thinking of Phone of Zeb.
Phone of Zeb. Of Zeb. That's it.
Yeah, I have trouble, like since I do so much different photography. I my Flickr account tends to be very scattered, and I kind of like it like that.
But mine too.
I do appreciate like. Consistency as well, but it just always sort of chafes at me, I started the multiple accounts so that I could have one account for black and white and one for color and one for pinhole and so on.
It's a really good idea, but it's so time consuming, isn't it?
Well, I rotate, so I don't post a photo to every one of those accounts every day. I only post a photo to one account a day, and so they're on like a 3 or 4 day rotation. But I'd be remiss if I didn't also encourage people to follow Blue Moon Camera.
Absolutely. I thought you were going to just miss that out.
Oh, no. And that's actually these days where, you know, I put in most of my work kind of behind the scenes, like photographing the cameras. And I follow the same philosophy. I don't want to just like do sort of fluffy camera portraits, but I try to like write a little bit about like either the history of the camera or why we are in love with the camera or some interested. I figure, you know, I want to give people a reason to tarry there for a moment or two.
It's a great website, and it's dangerous for me to linger too long on such websites. So Zeb, look, I look forward to meeting you in person. It'll happen.
I hope so, Andrew.
Yeah, Pacific Northwest is our next target for touring round, and it'll be within the next 5 years, I would think. So,
well, you let me know if you ever make that happen.
We will. No, we will make it happen. Don't worry, Zeb. Thank you so very much. You've been lovely.
Thank you, Andrew.
We don't miss Corey at all.
And carry on the good work with the podcast.
Thank you very much, Zeb, and take care.
All right.
Bye
now.
Have
a wonderful day.
Bye-bye.